How's it going, Andrew?
What's going on, Matt?
It's going all right. Glad to have you back.
Good to be back. How was the traveling? How was the crawfish boil?
It was good. Good. Really good time had by all. It's always a stellar event that they put on there, and food's good. Fellowship's good. There's nothing to complain about there.
So I don't think I've ever really been to a crawfish boil. I believe they dump it on the tables, right? So it's like a flashy.
Yeah.
Check out all these crawfish and corn
and potatoes and andouille sausage.
Oh,
yeah. You know, and then everybody just everybody reaches in because apparently I can't talk right now. But yeah, it's like a community pile of food. So, you know, everybody's reaching in, or we had some grabbers you could use too to kind of scoop stuff back towards you. But it was a really good time, like 60-ish people.
That's a good turnout.
Yeah. Yeah. Can't really complain about that for them. So, yeah, it was a good time. They came out with an awesome lapel pin this year for it.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty sweet. I'm looking forward to it in the future, especially since it's pretty close to my house.
Oh, that's always nice. Yeah, it looks like a really fun event. I kind of wish I could have gone, but it looks like, I mean, they've been doing it for a couple of years too, I believe, right?
Yeah, this is the third or fourth, I think, since Hayes has been doing it.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. So what's new with you?
No, man, I'm a little worse for wear this morning. Went to a concert last night, the Drowsy Lads.
You got to get out of the house, huh?
Oh, yeah. I told them the Drowsy Lads perform at Irish Fest, and I work one of the stages there. So I promised them that when they came back to Milwaukee, I'd come see them. So had to go pop by to see the show, which was fun. Still made it home at a reasonable midnight o'clock.
No, it's not bad.
Could be worse. I told everyone, like, dude, if I get any later, I'm going to be in big trouble. So I went home and, yeah, I woke up this morning. I'm a little bit tired. I also think I caught the sickness that's been going around everywhere and everyone's getting too. So I'm like a combo. I could tell I was like snoring all night for sure because I think my nose is stuffed up. So I am tired, but I'm here for fellowship.
There you go. Make sure you hit up some of that emergency stuff and get that out of your system before Thursday. We got a double E8.
Holy boy. I'll be fine. Cool. Well, let's kick this episode off, and we're going to talk today about the fun art of guarding the West Gate.
Woohoo.
Loosen up your ties and roll up your sleeves. It's time for Fellowship with Matt and Andrew. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Grand Lodge of Wisconsin or any other Grand Lodge or any appended body.
Baba Booey.
Awesome. Ooh, you haven't done that one.
So let's talk today. We're going to do the guarding the West Gate. So for our listeners who might not be as familiar, can you describe what we mean when we say guard the West Gate?
Sure. It means that you are taking the time to ensure that the people you are thinking about bringing into the fraternity, more specifically your lodge, especially, not only fit the culture that you've developed at your lodge, but also will adhere to the tenets of Freemasonry and make good Masons.
Yep, and support the reputation of the fraternity as well.
Right.
I think this is a topic that, I mean, people talk about it all the time, but I don't know if I've really noticed much changing in people trying to actually improve their West Gate, but I see a lot of people always harping on it. So I thought it'd be fun for us to talk about ways to try to improve that process and why it's so important. And I think within that, the importance is that a fraternity is only as good as its members. And if there's not a focus on saying it's not about having the most members, it's about having the right members, is very important for the success of the lodge and the fraternity as a whole.
Agreed. And, you know, it's very different between lodges, you know, what kind of effort you can put into, effort's not the right word, what kind of care you can put into guarding the West Gate. Because sometimes you get to that point where, you know, some lodges, they may not have seen a petitioner in a while. And they're just so excited. They're like, yeah, you know, let's get this guy in, and, you know, new member to the lodge, new energy. and maybe they don't focus as much on guarding the West Gate. And then you have lodges where, you know, petitions come in on the regular and they are very strict about their investigation process of a petitioner or how many times they make a petitioner visit before they give them a petition and things like that. And I think if we want to just go to the beginning, I think that's where it starts. And that's the most important part of your process is really getting to know the guy before you even put a petition in his hand.
And I think that's oftentimes where the mistake is made or where the easiest adjustment can be made. If you're just like, hey, how do I have an actionable thing to do? Some lodges will do a, if you come to two meetings, you can get a petition. And I go, I think that's a little too short. One, it can depend on how well the person's known. Like if he's been somebody that the lodge has been maybe friends with for a while, like outside of lodge meetings, it's a little less necessary. But if it's somebody who's just walking in for the first time, I think it's really important that you give that person the time to meet everybody. And when they're coming in, try to make sure that they're sitting with everybody because it's not really a formal investigation. But technically speaking, by everyone in the lodge getting to know him, they are becoming familiar with anything that could come up that could be questionable too.
So let's quantify this for a second here then. Through this conversation, let's focus on the guy that came to you from a Grand Lodge lead or saw your building and reached out because he was interested or
met, saw you on Facebook right, or
met somebody in passing, whatever. It's not somebody well known to anybody in the lodge, because if it's somebody that's well known to somebody in the lodge, that person is most likely vouching for him, which mm-hmm. kind of changes your process a little bit, right? You have a brother vouching already. So you're not going to necessarily take that extreme amount of time or as an extreme amount of time to get to know him beforehand, because somebody who's a part of your lodge is vouching for him. So let's take our random person off the street and we'll start with that.
Just a guy. And the thing is that I think a lot of our problems come from in American masonry, we have a lot of urgency. So it seems like we're always afraid to slow down. And he comes in and you're really starting to think already, okay, when am I planning this guy's degrees? And it's like, hold on, just get to know him. And I think, you know, 3 or 4 meetings is a good starting place where you can start to be like, okay, this would be a good time. But also I've always told these candidates coming in, once you feel you've met everyone, ask us for a petition instead of just shoving one down their throat, I guess, and being like, here you go, welcome to the lodge, here's a petition. Because I think it's nice because it puts the onus on the candidate to say, when do you feel like you are ready to start this process? Instead of like, I get it. They're like, well, what if he's just going to sit on his hands and not do it? And you're like, well, that's a good first test. Are they going to actually be willing? Like, I wasn't given a petition. I had to, when I'd come to probably 4 or 5 events, and then I went up to the master of the lodge at the time and was like, can I get a petition? So at that time, they were still, you know, I still had to ask. And I think that that is helpful because then you're not necessarily saying, we won't give you a petition until a certain period of time. But you're like, when you've come a good chunk of time, when you're ready, you ask. And that can kind of help that process too, as far as letting them get enough time to get to know everyone and feel like, you know, I think I do want to get a petition.
Right. I think you're absolutely right there. I think it would be good for them to ask for a petition after being here for a little bit. But at the same time, if you know they're going to be a good fit and they've been around for a little bit, I feel like there's not a problem handing them the petition. Just because, you know, you go back to the old saying, to be one, ask one, right? They already did that part. That's why they're here now meeting us. And I think it's important that they might not know what that next step is unless you've clearly explained it to them, right? Which is another part of the process I think we should address. I think a lot of times we have these guys come in the door and we're like, hey, yeah, cool, thanks for coming for dinner. Come again for dinner. But we don't really explain to them what the process looks like to end up joining.
Yep.
Right? So they come to dinner and then they get sent away after dinner while we go in and do our meeting. And you know, if you haven't explained that to them, they're sitting there going, well, what the, they told me to come back for dinner, but they didn't tell me anything about joining or anything else. And like, what am I supposed to do now? Like, so I think to define clear expectations up front with that person who's interested in coming and visiting.
Yep. And that's why I've done it multiple times where I like to say, come visit a few times, come to a couple events. And then when you're ready, ask for a petition, because at least then it sets, there's not as much ambiguity of like, well, how do I get to the next step? It's like, you'll know when you want to take the next step and then you let us know. And if it's been, and you've met enough people, and it's been long enough and you know, or the other way I put it is, until you ask for a petition, once you've made enough connections with people through conversation that you feel comfortable that you could get someone to vouch for you, like a top and bottom signer. Mm-hmm. Because I've seen too many times where the top and bottom signer becomes more of a formality than it is an actual responsibility.
Right.
And I think people forget, like I've had seen it where like, someone comes in, it's like, I need signers. And then someone's like, I guess I'll do it. It's like, no, you should know who your signers are going to be, because there's this thing where I feel like we forget that when you're vouching, so let's say, for example, you sign as the top signer, okay? And you didn't do any getting to know this person. And then you suddenly, you know, this person burns down a building in Milwaukee and you go, what? And you look on his Facebook and you look and he's been talking about arson for months, then your negligence, that is, you are being held, you should be held responsible for that. I would even argue under Masonic charges, if you willfully, like, it's one thing if he's secretly doing something, you would have never known. That's not on you. But if it was so obvious that there was a problem here and then you just signed your name, I think that you are vouching and putting your neck out. And so you should take it very seriously if you are going to sign a petition and vouch for them and say, hey, you better be comfortable that this guy's not going to do something horrible or something that was very catchable before you put your name down. And I think that's a good check and balance to remember that it is important before you sign that document that you are comfortable vouching for that person.
Right. Agreed. And that's the whole point of a top line signer, right? That's supposed to be the person that's vouching the most. That's their proposer. The bottom line signer is just agreeing with the top line signer, right? It's just a double check.
Yep. I'd say, I mean, it's like, just do your due diligence before you even start the investigation process. So once he asks for a petition, you have people who are confident in this person being a good fit for the fraternity. So they get a top and bottom line signer. Then we move on to the next step, which is...
I wasn't quite done there yet, but
we can go back.
I want to back up a second, and I want to say one of the biggest things I tell these guys, even prior to them having a petition, and this is something I feel like is important for lodges to think about, is that this is a two-way interview and getting to know each other process. We're not just getting to know you. You're getting to know us, and we have to be a good fit for you. Now, in more rural areas, maybe it's not as easy to go, yeah, you know what? I think you'd be a great Mason, but that other lodge has the culture that we feel like would fit you better. But in Milwaukee, we have that opportunity, right? Where we can be like, hey, you're a cool dude, you know, or he can say, hey, can I check out another lodge? I just feel like maybe there's a different vibe that would fit better for me. And I think that pays off farther down the line in member retention.
Yep.
You know, so I think it's important for us to remember that as much as we're getting to know them and interviewing them, they're getting to know us as well before we ever hand them a petition.
Yeah, and I've done a similar thing where I try to during that same part that we're talking about where you explain the joining process of encouraging the petitioner to visit multiple lodges.
Yeah.
And I've heard you say it, and in a similar way that you just said it, where it's like, we're interviewing each other and you should be really thinking during this process, do I like these people? because I always say a line like, because if you don't like anyone here, you're going to have a really bad time. And I said, so you really got to be like, can I hang out with these people minimum once a month for some hours and enjoy that? Right. And if the answer is, I really don't like them, but I want to be a Mason, you don't have to stay in that lodge. You can go and visit some other ones and see if there's one that you do feel like you really fit in with. And then that's a good opportunity just to, you know, that's where you would grow the most anyways.
Right, Right. I agree. And that's important. Membership at your own lodge is important, but keeping the person in the fraternity and having them have an enjoyable experience in the fraternity is ultimately the goal. And if that means that they would fit in better at a different lodge that has a different culture, does different sorts of activities, then there's no reason you shouldn't maybe have them go visit that lodge as well.
We just got to remember we're all on the same team, to be honest. And I think sometimes lodges can get competitive with one another, and they all want to be successful and grow, but not at the expense of, you know, having a Mason be happy or a future Mason be happy. And I think we really have to remember we're all on the same team, and, you know, it's all for the good of the same order. So,
right.
You know, it all works out in the long run anyways.
All right. Exactly. So let's move on to the next point then, where we were heading before I made us backtrack. So you guys got the petition, top and bottom line sign, turn back in. Next thing that happens is...
it goes to the Grand Lodge to approve and to do a background check. And not all lodges or Grand Lodges do the background checks, but it's a good practice that we do here. But it's a good reminder too that any lodge could request a background check, even if it wasn't necessarily a Grand Lodge requirement. But I think it's a great practice because that's a very easy way just to sift through some information that could be really... you'd want to know about it.
Right. Well, and when you're doing that kind of thing, like, yeah, you have like circuit court access and stuff like that. You can look them up on. Right. But I think it's important to remember that, you know, maybe you want to do a national database background check because maybe they lived in another state prior to this. Maybe they didn't, but maybe they traveled to another state and did something, you know, that you would want to know about.
And so basically what this step contains is this is going to be where you're starting to do high level research. So this isn't even to the point where you're doing one-on-one interviews, but this is a good point where you start to look for the, you know, like online available types of information. And, you know, criminal records don't necessarily always reject you from the fraternity, but you definitely want to know what the situation is before you let someone in, and right. Then judge it based on the context and timelines and how long it's been and all that kind of normal stuff that a lodge should think about very seriously when picking a candidate or, you know, looking through a candidate's stuff. And a lot of the stuff is also checking to make sure that what they wrote, that they meet our requirements, such as a belief in a supreme being, being of good moral character, things like that, that they actually are telling the truth.
Right. Right. Yeah. A background check is a good way to suss out if somebody was untruthful on their petition or, you know, something like that. So is doing a social media check and trying to, you know, see what they're posting on a regular basis, if they have social media accounts and things like that. You know, it's all good stuff to start looking at to get an idea further of who this person is. Right.
And so then after that point, we'd be assigning an investigation committee. Mm-hmm. And the investigation committee, so here's where I think people run into problems with the investigation committee. At least within our jurisdiction, there's a set process. And I find that the investigation committee sometimes can say, well, my only job is just to complete this paperwork.
Right.
And they recently in our jurisdiction made it a little more broad where they're like, okay, instead of us asking like the same 10 questions, I want to you to solve the, is he of good moral character? Right. And that means you need to use your mind and use your communication skills to try to ascertain that information. So I think in our jurisdiction, we do good moral character, family life, and what's the third one?
Time.
I don't think it's time.
No, it's not time. I don't remember.
But so there's a couple of categories that you're trying to basically fill out. And when I've done those interviews, I try to, you know, do it in a place such as the family's home and be able to talk to their family and be like, are you chill with this and stuff like that? So you really should take the time and energy, not just to say, I just need you to check some boxes, but to really try to get to know the person and say, okay, what would help me understand if they're of good moral character? You can ask them stuff like, you know, do you like, do you have any interest in serving in the community? Have you ever had anything you've done that's proud? You can even ask them, what do you think good moral character is? Sometimes I've found just asking them to explain to me what a good person is can really help you understand what their thoughts are on good character too.
Well, and we have that base list of questions that covers a lot of that stuff. And typically the investigation committees I've been on, we've divided that list up between the three of us in one way or another so that we knew all the questions got hit. That doesn't mean you have to exclusively ask only your questions. I typically try to get on investigation committees where I didn't have much of an opportunity to interact with the person while they were visiting, because now this is an opportunity for a fresh set of eyeballs to look at it and for me to get to know the person who, you know, is potentially coming into our lodge. I've spent 2 hours at somebody's home just talking and going down the rabbit holes and answering their questions and having them answer my questions. But back to that list, and my original point is I have favorite questions I like to ask on there that I feel like can suss things out. So even if those aren't part of my assigned questions, I add them to my assigned questions because I want to know the answer.
And it's important too, like when you are sussing stuff out or you're doing your interview, like really pay attention and listen closely and don't just ask a question and then get a response and move on to the next. Probe deeper. Like if there's something about it that they say that is interesting or you're curious about, ask a follow-up question on what their response was, because you'll find that if people are putting on their like interview mode, like I'm in interview mode, I'm just going to say what always sounds good. When you make them go a level or two deeper on what they're talking about, it starts to become more honest. It starts to become a little less guarded because they're not able to just go with their blanket, easy, quick, like, you know, what's a good man? I think a good man's somebody who, you know, does nice things. And you're like, what type of nice thing? Like, you know, you have to push them to really explain themselves. And that's where you get more of the sincere information. And then also you can find in those things where someone is maybe not being honest because they were just hoping you would take it at face value. And it's important to take the time when you are interviewing to be observant, like observe their demeanor, observe if you're visiting their home, what does their home life look like? Is there anything in there that seems suspect or that seems like it could be problematic? And you really need to keep your eyes out and try to be an actual investigator. You're not just doing steps because you're trying to get done as fast as possible, fill out your sheet and get this guy in. You're really trying to keep your eyes open and peeled and to actually think the whole time, is there something here that would make me concerned?
Right, right. Exactly. It's necessary that you do your due diligence, which goes beyond what's just on the paper.
And you know what I have a hard time with sometimes? So there's the bare minimum requirements to be a Mason, be a good man, have a belief in supreme being, be a man of lawful age, and all that kind of stuff. But there'll be some people that I've seen that it's like, you check these boxes, so technically you're not qualified. But then I sometimes wonder, like, but would you actually be really helpful as a Mason? Like, can you actually do the work? And that's where it can get a little weird, because that's where like the personal decision is, where you're like, is this guy actually have something to give back to the fraternity? Is he going to be a good and active member, or is he just going to be, he met the qualifications to be a Mason? And I wrestle with that a lot.
That is a hard one. At the end of the day, though, Masonry is designed to make good men better, right? So maybe when you're first going through the interview process and everything with him, maybe, yeah, he just checks the boxes. But that also leaves a lot of room for growth. So I don't think you can discount a candidate under those grounds. You have to look at the fact that maybe he's going to be one of the people that benefits the most from what the fraternity has to offer.
I mean, that's a fair point too. It just can get away from me because like what a good man is kind of, it can be very vague. He could just be a meh man. He's like, this guy's just very meh. Like, I don't know in what ways, like, you know, and I like to ask questions too to start getting in their mind, like, when you join this organization, what can you do? Like, what can you bring to the organization to, as like, you know, your strengths? Like, what do you, how can you be of service kind of thing? Because we are all serving the lodge and one another. So it can be kind of hard where you're like, you know, there's this huge talk about how we need to be more selective to make sure we're getting exceptional people, good men, and making them better. And that, you know, some of the criticisms are that we accept unexceptional people who are fine, and then they are just fine everywhere they go. And that can be kind of the challenges. I've never thrown a black ball over it, but it always sits in my mind sometimes when I'm doing those processes. Like, you'll get some guys where you're like, wow, this guy's awesome, he's going to be the best. And then you'll get some guys where you're like, I guess it's fine. And it, that's can be kind of complicated. And I don't really know how to always handle that. And if I understand your point too, where you're like, but you don't know, this could really like make a difference. And I do agree, but I think it's, you have to keep an eye out for when there is fertile soil and when there is just blah.
I don't necessarily disagree with what you're saying, but I don't.
Are we going to disagree for once?
I think we are. I'm just trying to find my words here. You know what? Actually, I don't think that should be a factor in the investigating committee. And I don't think that should be a factor as to whether you let somebody into the fraternity or not. If they're a good man and they check the boxes and they're going to be a sideliner for their entire Masonic career and not go through the officer line or not do anything like that, that's fine. They're still going to be benefit from being part of the fraternity. And the fraternity is potentially going to benefit from having them there if they're always there, always supportive, help where they can, you know, things like that. And even if they don't, even if they just show up and have a good time and enjoy fellowship and people get along with them, that's enough.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, and it's one of those things too, where it's like, I guess then that plays into the be selective with your officer line too. Like, because if someone's just totally basically like, you're very qualified to be here, but not really take on high levels of responsibility, you really need to be careful with that. But yeah, that's where I can always get a little bit challenged in those two, is that there's a lot of people who are qualified, but I wouldn't always say they're always worthy, which can kind of sound snooty, I guess. But it, you know, that's part of the process too, is seeing if they're actually a good fit for your lodge as well. So that's the other thing, is we're saying, if this guy's going to be a horrible fit for your lodge, but still checks all the boxes, do you just, you know, send him through the degrees? It can get a little complicated in trying to figure out.
When it comes to a fit for your lodge, you're hoping if he's just not really vibing with the type of culture you have going on, you're hoping you can send him to a, you know, another lodge that would fit him better, right? That's the hope. But if you get a guy that's not really vibing with the culture of your lodge, and him going to another lodge isn't an option, what can you do to make him feel welcome?
That's true. So yeah, so when you're doing the investigation, you have to make sure you are really being conscious and trying. I guess what we're saying here is make sure he checks all the boxes, but it can be hard to always know. Because there's been definitely people where they seem to check the boxes and you find out later, maybe they didn't. And so it does just mean that you have to take your due diligence to make sure that if you're on that committee, that you are confident in giving a fair assessment.
Right. And none of us are perfect. So every now and then, yeah, you might get something that slips through the cracks. You hope not to, and you try to do the best you possibly can to not have that happen. But it's going to happen sometimes, or you're going to have somebody that looks great coming into the fraternity, and 5 years later, they're a completely different person and not in the way we hoped they'd be, you know? So you can't predict everything. You just need to do your due diligence to be confident in the decision you are making, allowing the person in.
So once that point's done, they have a master's board. Similar process. This is a good opportunity. If you have a master's board at your lodge, make sure that you try to attend those. That's another opportunity for additional questions to be asked of the candidate and for them to ask questions for us.
The master's board is actually one of the favorite parts of my process, because you've now had the interview investigation committee put this petitioner through their paces and find out a lot of stuff. And then you can just put them in a room with a bunch of master masons and they can ask whatever they want. And everybody's going to have different different questions about, you know, whether it be why they're here, what they're into outside of, you know, work, what they do for work, all that kind of stuff. These guys that maybe haven't interacted with this person a bunch all have the opportunity to ask their question, listen to the other questions and answers, and get to know this guy in a setting that usually is, and let's be honest, slightly intimidating potentially, because you can put like 10 people in the room with the petitioner. But it always ends up, most of the time, it ends up being a light atmosphere with a lot of laughing going on and just a good time, and everybody gets to know each other better by the end of it, and the petitioner gets to know you guys better as well.
You know what a good question is to ask there too? What are you expecting to get out of masonry? Can be a really good one to actually go, are you looking for masonry or are you looking for something else? I was reading an article the other day where they were talking about, are you sure you're trying to be a Freemason? And it was talking about how sometimes they'll listen to guys like, it sounds like what you're looking for is the Rotary Club. And they're like, so they're like, you're like, I just want to network and really help my business like acumen. And they're like, maybe the Rotary Club or the Lions or other stuff where there's other groups too. And so it can be good to see like, are what they're looking to get what masonry is offering, or are they looking to get something that isn't really in masonry? Because then you can, I mean, you don't even, at that point, it might not even go to a ballot. You can be like, you're in the wrong place, dude. You got confused. This is Freemasonry, man.
You know, or yeah. Yep. I would agree. I haven't run into that yet, but I would agree.
It can be weird because when I was reading it, I was thinking about it, and it's just like, what do you want to do? It's like, I just want to serve food to my brethren. And you're like, we do that here, but is that really what we want the fraternity to become? Or is like, would you be a better fit for like the Lions Club or something? Like, I just want to serve bratwurst. And you're like, okay, that's fun. You really, I mean, what I'm always looking to hear is I want to like work on myself and improve and have a community and kind of do what our sales pitch is. Whereas I do feel like a lot of people come in here wanting it to be something else. And then that's where we get a lot of these things where lodges are focused on just doing something that's closer to a Lions Club or something, where it's like, no, you need to do masonry though too. And that can get a little complicated if people joining masonry aren't sincerely wanting masonry, they're wanting something else, and enough people of that join, and then it becomes that other thing. And you're like, well, we have our own value that we're offering. And if someone's not interested in that value, it can get a little weird.
Yeah, I agree. Where else do we want to go with this?
So it would be like the balloting process would be next, and that's your last chance.
Right. Last chance to decide that the person shouldn't be there for sure.
Yep. Or should be there.
Or should be there.
And so I think that people are uncomfortable utilizing their power in that situation. And I would encourage brethren, if they did know things in advance, people should have heard about it probably before it gets to this point. But if it's being willfully ignored for some reason, that there's a huge problem, like a massive felony, and for some reason it's going through, that is your last opportunity to say, I'm going to nix this because for some reason we're not, but it cannot go through. And I think it's important to be cautious with that, but also to use it when necessary. If extreme circumstance arises, you know, there's all these nightmare stories about people getting blackballed over things that they shouldn't, like religious differences and things like that. And that's like the don't do that. But you should also still be prepared to use that privilege if it is warranted by something that is irreconcilable with our requirements.
Right, right. And I think it's important to remember that the power of blackballing somebody is very important and only to be used when absolutely necessary. And a lot of jurisdictions actually have it set up to the point where if you cast a blackball on somebody for an illegitimate reason, you can be brought up on Masonic charges over it, which I think is appropriate, because the power of being able to blackball somebody is a huge responsibility, and it needs to be done for the right reasons and not the wrong reasons.
And if you have the right reason, and it's weird because I believe like traditionally you weren't able to even ask the why. It's when, well, someone around here said no, which I think kind of makes sense. But at the same time, I guess, how do you maintain the anonymity that it requires if you're asking, okay, whoever did that, let me know why?
Well, so the way it works or is supposed to work is the person that does it has X number of hours to have a personal conversation with the worshipful master regarding the reasons as to why. And, you know, true to some of our obligations, you should not, that conversation happens in private and the worshipful master should not be divulging any of the, well, anything that's not necessary details, AKA who the person was.
I can see both sides of that too, where I'm like, there should be some oversight, but then it kind of defeats the, like, why is it anonymous? If it's not anonymous. I wish you could just slip a letter in the mailbox and be like, I'm just going to slip a letter, you know, put a letter in the mailbox in the next whatever days and we'll review it then. But because I know that some jurisdictions that's absolutely like, but it just depends place to place.
Right. Well, and I mean, I'm sure a letter would be fine too, as long as it was, you know, the reasons were given why and it was undersigned. But, you know, the way it works is, well, I mean, anybody who's a Mason listening to this knows what our obligations are. And therefore, if that conversation is asked to be kept in private and is supposed to be a private conversation, that's the way it should remain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously, if the brother acted in a way that is inappropriate and would justify, you know, being like, hey, no, dude, we can't blackball somebody for that. And depending on how hard it went against Masonic tenants, potentially, then, yeah, maybe you do have to look at bringing up charges and make it a little more public. But at that point, somebody's acting in the opposite interest of the fraternity.
Always fun.
Oh, yeah. It's a fine line to walk, man. It's a fine line to walk.
Cool. I guess so, you know, basically the whole reminder is just don't rush your investigation process. If you are going to sign as a top or bottom signer, understand that you're sticking your neck out for this person. So be comfortable that you know them well enough to do so. Don't rush giving them a petition. Take the time to get to know them. Be observant. Do your due diligence. Don't be negligent. And make sure that we're trying to get people who should be here, so we don't have to deal with the drama of people who shouldn't.
Oh, yeah. There's been plenty of that in the fraternity lately, too. Yeah. So, not here in Wisconsin, elsewhere.
Anywhere but here.
And on that note, before we get into news and events, remember to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and X. And if you have any comments, questions, concerns about the podcast, feel free to reach out to us on any of those platforms or email us at timeforfellowship@gmail.com.
Timeforfellowship@gmail.com. All right, we're going to get into some news and events. All right. So, what's been going on in Wisconsin? News article I want to talk about today is a very cool donation. The Freemasons of Hartford Masonic Center, 120, recently donated $1,000 to the Medical Center Foundation of Hartford to support the Professional Emergency Lifeline Program. So what is the Lifeline Program? The program offers 24-hour connection to a highly trained professionals, advanced personnel, and monitoring techniques, and a peace of mind. And it's been doing that for over 180 elderly and disabled individuals in the Hartford community. This was made possible through the Acts of Kindness program, another great reason to keep donating to Acts of Kindness, and it was a great contribution done by the Hartford Mason.
Awesome. That's pretty awesome. All right, we'll jump into events now, and pretty much all the events that are coming up in the next week or so had RSVP days, so we'll skip right past those and we'll start with March 3rd. Reedsburg Lodge number 79 is doing their chicken pie pickup. They do some pretty awesome chicken pot pies. Reach out to Reedsburg Lodge for more information.
I don't even think they're pot pies. I think they're deep dish chicken.
Ooh.
Pies.
It sounds good.
Yeah, it does sound good. Maybe you have to find a way to do that sometime. On March 9th, the Tom Torville Interstate Lodge's Table Lodge, 4 p.m. social hour, 5 p.m. meal at the Toma Masonic Center. RSVP to District 5 Deputy Jacob Schultz if you want to go to that. On March 23rd, Valley of La Crosse Scottish Rite reunion at the La Crosse Masonic Center from 9 to 4 p.m. Also on March 23rd is the District 1 District Meeting, 10 a.m. at the Iron River Masonic Center. And a Masonic Bowling Tournament follows at 1 p.m. Please make your Reservations with Brother Pat Norden for that. On March 28th, the Valley of Madison Scottish Rite has their Feast of the Paschal Lamb. To backtrack a second, on March 9th, Silas Shepherd will be at the Watoma Lodge. So if you're interested in going and checking that out, please do. I believe it's 8:30 for carbs. I'm sure it's probably on Facebook somewhere if you look it up, or in the Wisconsin Masonic Journal, or on our lodge page, which is a very useful tool if you make use of it.
And just remember, this year Silas is actually traveling around the entire state of Wisconsin, so they'll be in Toma, and then they're going to be going to a couple other cities near you, so keep it in mind.
Watoma. Do that all the time. Toma is actually a city, and so is Watoma.
Coming to a city near you.
All right, on to April. From April 5th to the 7th, the Scottish Rite Valley of Madison presents Native Spirit at the Wisconsin Masonic Center. Tickets are $35. You can see your Wisconsin Masonic Journal for more information. On April 13th is the District 5 Spring Meeting. Social hour at 7:30 a.m. for pancakes and coffee. Meeting from 9 to 11 at the Sparta Masonic Center. On April 13th, there's a Masonic Acts of Kindness Gala fundraiser at the Lake Masonic Center. See your Wisconsin Masonic Journal or hopefully one of your district mailers for more information on that. On April 20th, Silas Shepherd will be doing a presentation of play entitled In Defense of the Ruffians. Coffee and carbs at 9 a.m., gavel at 10 a.m., and that will be at the Northwest Masonic Center here in Milwaukee. Well, Wauwatosa, technically. April 24th, Valley of Madison Scottish Rite Spring Reunion. It'll be putting on three different degrees. Reach out to them for more information. April 27th, the Valley of Madison Scottish Rite Spring Reunion continues with four of the other degrees. Reach out to them for more information on that. April 29th is the District 12 Spring Meeting. Location to be determined for that still. And on April 29th, Ozaki Lodge number 17 is having a table lodge and fish boil. Gathering at 5:30 p.m. They open at 6. $25 a person. All Masons are welcome. Please respond to Worshipful Master Schroeder at his email or phone number.
Cool. And that's events.
Oh, what? I do have one more I want to add real quick. March 16th, there will be a school of instruction here in District 12 hosted at Lake Lodge by our district lecturer, and that will open at 9 a.m. Coffee and carbs beforehand.
Cool. Well, thanks for joining us today and having some fellowship with us.
We'll see how our numbers do with Andrew back.
Don't do that to me. All right. You guys take care.
Have a good one.